The Guardian.
Welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Back in 2008, Kate Summerscale won the Samuel Johnson Prize for Non-Fiction with The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher. The book is primarily about the murder of a three-year-old boy at his home, Road Hill House, near Bath in 1860, but it's also an account of the birth of modern policing with the arrival on the crime scene of the first detectives. And it's a history of the very earliest detective novels. So John Mullen began his discussion by asking Kate whether she'd known about all these connections when she started researching her story.
I came across it as a factual story, and I was gripped by it first and foremost as that. And the fact that this really happened was very important to my interest in the story. But I did quite early on realise that there was a relationship between, quite a close relationship between this story and the fiction of the period, and that excited and intrigued me. As I carried on researching, I realised that that relationship was sort of stronger, more diverse and stranger than I first realised, and it became at the centre of the book, really.
Well, how did that relationship first become clear to you?
There were references to Edgar Allan Poe that made me aware that Poe's stories had only just been published in the 1840s, and that was when the detective force was founded, and it struck me that these pioneer detectives in Scotland Yard didn't have any kind of guide to how to detect, and the only guide that they could feasibly have reached for would have been a fictional one, and that the emergence of detection in fact and fiction was kind of simultaneous. And I also very early on realised that Inspector Witcher was a model for Wilkie Collins' Sergeant Cuff in The Moonstone, which in turn leads into sort of Sherlock Holmes and the detectives of today. And later on, I realised that the relationship between the Road Hill murder and The Moonstone was quite intricate and deep. And the ways in which the newspapers wrote about this story were very sort of derived from the sensation fiction of the period. Sensation fiction of the period drew on the newspaper reports. It was all so entangled together, and I found that really interesting.
Yeah, when a sort of murder, a real murder mystery is covered now, we all find ourselves thinking about it in terms of, which are actually borrowed from fiction, which
yes.
are borrowed almost inescapably, as if, you know, the two have just grown up together, the real detective, and because they seem to be chronologically very close together, real detectives operating professionally and detective stories.
So much so that the expectations that were placed on Jack Witcher, for instance, were partly derived from the detective stories that people were picking up and reading in railway stations as they went about their business. And so fiction sort of generated its own pressures and demands on real people, as well as the real life crimes being fodder for fiction. So it was very much a two-way process, and sort of almost impossible to disentangle in a sense, and that seemed, I don't know, some sort of corollary for the ways in which a detective trying to solve a case is bringing to it all his fantasies and expectations and experience, which are derived from fiction, but derived also from the sort of stories that he tells himself about the world, and will distort what he sees, but it's still the only way of seeing.
Is it also that thing which what happens when a detective goes in is that a very respectable family or social group is revealed actually to have underneath it all sorts of dark passions and relationships which only get revealed by the process of detection?
Yes, and that was the case in Dickens' Bleak House, as
yes.
well as in The Moonstone, and there is a very strong sort of class element to that, of the detective and the journalist to some extent, as there's a sort of parallel to the detective, but going in and telling stories and speculating as well as revealing in ways that really do cross some barrier of privacy and difference. And I think that that was part of what made Witcher's endeavour so dangerous seeming to the public, but also so exciting, because of course the public are in the role of the detective. They're going in with him, and so it's a very uneasy relationship of he's their sort of hero and champion and trying to solve the mystery, but also represents some of what is prurient and voyeuristic about them, the newspaper readers, and by extension about me as a researcher and writer, and somebody reading the book. Mm-hmm. So this idea of people playing detective and the excitements and also the risks of that did seem to me, as I wrote the book, to work at different levels, both in within the story but also the process of researching, writing and reading such a story.
You have to be quite careful and reticent, don't you, about, or it appears that you're quite careful and reticent and therefore quite manipulative of the reader in withholding things.
And I think in when I was first writing the book in a sort of earlier draft, that my focus was so much on sort of clarity. I wanted to make everything as clear as possible, and it was only later that I thought actually it's not the only virtue and that to make the story work, to make the reader enter into Witcher's anxiety, confusion, despair and the public spirit, I needed to sort of recreate in time as these things were revealed. And so of course I knew from the beginning, because I, you know, when I first read about the case, what the outcome was. But it was the fact that when I first read about the case, I'd never heard of it before, and nobody that I knew had, gave me the opportunity to recreate it as if we didn't know the ending, as if we were living through it.
Because I had read The Moonstone, I didn't know about the murder. So when Witcher says, you know, it's Constance, and it is her, I thought, oh, it can't be her. It's got to be the dad somehow.
It's probably halfway through or two-thirds of the way through this book that that Constance confesses.
Yes, two-thirds, I'd
so,
say.
Yeah. And in a detective novel, that's right at the end. Yes. I mean, I did find in his reports a further twist that enabled me to have something that cast what had gone before in a new light at the very end, the suggestion that William was involved. But I thought people will think when Constance confesses, this can't be the real answer because the book's not over.
Yeah.
If this was an episode of Inspector Morse,
well, it's true,
you know,
it's true. I was
for quite
a long time she was in the prison, and I was thinking, that was too easy. That, and these dodgy religious people who've encouraged her to confess. Yeah. Well, what's...
No, it's sort of a double bluff, yes. I suppose, in ways that I hadn't anticipated. It plays with expectations once you start writing in a certain fictional form, and the factual stuff will conform to, you know, will play along up to a point, but then will kind of undermine it in perhaps surprising ways.
One of the extraordinary bits, the letters people wrote to Witcher about with their theories.
You would have expected a little bit more respect and assumption of integrity and morality, because as you say, at the time there was nothing really to indicate, just sort of some rumours that Mr. Kent was anything but an upright man and a grieving father. And yet people were very ready to speculate that he was having an affair with various members of his staff. And that seemed, you know, revealing of what went on in Victorian
society. Do you think
society?
It is that? I mean, because it's very difficult not to read that and think, this must be kind of evidence that people assume that that's what usually happened or often happened.
But also maybe of that fantasy.
And Dickens, even, you know, Dickens writing, saying, oh, yes, it's absolutely clear.
Yes, he wrote to two people, one Collins and someone else with his theory, that it must have been the father and the nursemaid. No question.
Yeah.
That was it. And in this sense also, this story seemed to me like some of the best detective fiction, to reveal that what you really want to know or what you really learn isn't just about who the killer was, but more broadly, whether it's in a society, more distinctly in the family.
It is a mystery. It would be an extraordinary case if it happened today. But why does it become a sort of contemporary myth, do you think?
Some of the things you've touched on about the opening up of this middle class, respectable home to scrutiny and the horrors that were revealed that lay behind the violence. The mysteriousness of it is actually very unusual, I think, in real life. This case went unsolved for 5 years, and that was a big space in which people could speculate, first of all openly, and then after Constance was acquitted, in effect, you know, sort of not charged, more surreptitiously in a way in fiction. And so I think in those years there was a space where people could wonder, and I think that's what filled it out to become a myth. And I think Witcher's role in this was very significant, because this was one of the first times that a detective had been, as it were, a character in the story. And he went out there, the hero from Scotland Yard, the best detective in the land, all set to solve the case. And he returned in disgrace and ruined.
And there's quite a lot which rather surprised me about people being really hostile to the whole idea of the profession of the sort of...
Yes,
detective.
That surprised me. The idea that it's just un-English, un-British, to have state-sponsored spies, which is what detectives were thought of as. Police was bad enough. There was a lot of resistance to there being a police force on those grounds. But a detective, because he didn't wear a uniform and therefore was somehow sneaky and was seen as very threatening to the very idea of Englishness and the privacy and independence of individual Britons.
You know, you think Witcher, he's this sort of supposedly brilliant detective, and to put it very bluntly, he's got no forensic science, has he? He's got nothing.
No.
And I wonder if, I don't know, there's something about the murder mystery in the 19th century that when Witcher says the culprit will confess, it's almost like an article of faith, because that's the only way in the end that you're going to get the culprit.
And I think much of his manoeuvring, his tactics, were really about provoking a confession.
Well, pressurising.
Yes. Yeah. And that was really the only route. There was also the obsession with the nightdress and finding the nightdress. But again, I think the nightdress would have been the tool with which he would extract his confession.
Yeah.
So the confession was what he wanted. So it really was a battle of wills.
Even that, if they found a dress with blood on it.
Yeah, even that. Well, in fact, they did find, the police did find one. Yes. They decided it was menstrual blood and allowed it to be destroyed.
Yeah.
So no, it could only be from her. So there is something very intense, the standoff between Witcher and Constance. It has to be an emotive and psychological drama, really, that plays out.
Yeah. She confesses in every sense. And isn't it right that then that her own lawyer, when it comes to the trial, says to her, you know, you can say not guilty. And there's a good chance, even though you've said confess, we'll still get you off.
It was very controversial that the priest in question wouldn't divulge the secrets of the confessional. So even though she'd confessed to the court, the sense that there was this confession that was out of reach was very enraging to the legal establishment and went against the sort of normal Church of England procedures because of him treating the confessional with such respect. In my view, and I think in Witcher's view, the thing that it might have contained was a complete account of the crime that incriminated her brother.
Yeah.
And that she might have confessed that before God, but in a pragmatic way, because she wanted to save her brother from the cloud of suspicion, to the court, she may have tailored her confession and designed it so that it would protect him.
And then you find out that having sort of got this really strong sense of this sort of aquarium expert and his afterlife, there's the twist. And that's quite a calculated way of of introducing that twist.
Of playing it, I guess so, yes. And I did get really interested in William and thought it was astonishing that he'd had this afterlife and had been this pioneer of exploring the Great Barrier Reef. And I loved his drawings and watercolours. I guess I kind of wanted him to mean something in this story. And maybe it was the wanting that made me notice when I reread Witcher's reports, that Witcher repeated the boy knows something and is perhaps involved, and that had never come out at the time.
Mm. There's one more question I wanted to ask about the ending, which is the thing which you call, where you use the word mystery of this, and it's the most mysterious thing to me too, which is that when Constance or Emily, as she's now calling herself, mm-hmm. goes off to Australia, she seems to have cordial relations, not just with William, but actually her other siblings and the half-siblings too, doesn't
yes.
she? Who are the siblings of the child, of the three-year-old child that she murdered.
Mm. The only way I could think of it about it really was that if something that terrible happens within a family, and something that has such roots within the family that did implicate the father, the stepmother, everyone in some way, if not in the murder, at least in some kind of negligence or corruption, or that they understand each other. You know, they're bound by this event more than by any sense of who's good and who's bad, who did the wrong thing and who was innocent. It's more that they're all defined in some private way by that experience and have to keep quiet about it. And so maybe that bond was so strong, however it was forged. Yeah. If that happens in a family, it must do something extraordinary to the dynamic of the family if there's a killing within it.
Okay, well, we've got a travelling mic. Oh, brilliant. There's a gentleman there straight away.
I found it tantalising, that's the word you used yourself just now, in particular about the discrepancies, about the blood, for example. Were you at all tempted to put in about what you think probably happened, or did you prefer deliberately to leave it open to the reader to continue to be tantalised in the way that any Victorian reader of a Victorian novel might continue to feel?
I liked there being some openness at the end. I didn't, when I started on this, I wasn't setting out to solve the mystery again. It was more as a kind of social, cultural history. But somehow the way that I just got drawn, sucked into it and couldn't help myself wanting to, do what a detective does or deliver to the reader what a detective novel would aim for. In terms of a solution, but I didn't want the solution to be too definite or pat, even if I'd been able to convince myself of that, because I think that would be a bit sort of untrue to the factuality of it.
About the house, what's happened to it? Have you been to see it? And who's living there? And has there been a torrent of rubberneckers outside it since the book was published? Have you been there?
I went there while researching the book, and the woman who lived there showed me round and talked to me about the case. She knew about it, and it was amazing to visit. It was one of those moments when I was reminded of the historical reality of this thing. This really happened here, you know, in these rooms. And the house was very much as it had been. The privy in which the boy's body was found had been destroyed, sort of out of respect, and a garden built there. But the layout of the house matched almost exactly the floor plans I had from 1860. It's since changed hands couple of times, I think. There have been other families. The latest one, I think, is very sort of interested in the story, but I think there has been a little bit of, you know, people peering, which is quite appropriate because it's the whole, you know, the story of the case all over again, of people trying to peer into the great house and the high walls around it and being curious about what's inside.
I'm not an avid consumer of crime fiction, but I have a sense, you know, the great building blocks were Agatha Christie, Arthur Conan Doyle, and so on. Is there any sense, or do you have a sense that Witcher's downfall at the time turned writers away from orthodox police work and made them want to explore, in fact, unorthodox private detectives, private investigators, outliers who were working in unorthodox ways.
Yeah, definitely. I was very struck by how there was a brief sort of flowering of the police detective hero, but Sergeant Cuff in The Moonstone gets it wrong, and then that's the end of that for police detectives.
Yeah. The police are idiots is the most established convention,
yes,
isn't it? The police are idiots.
So I think that there was a real turning point with Witcher, that with his disgrace came a disgrace, you know, a kind of staining of the whole idea of the police detective. And it didn't really, this is very broad brushstroke, but as far as I can see, didn't really recover. The police detective didn't really recover his dignity till after the Second World War. So it was about 100 years, a century of disgrace. And then we've gone back to sort of police procedurals and the sort of slightly grimy, shabby police detectives, flawed, but you know, working within the constraints of a system that you know, it's difficult for them to flourish in, but they manage, and that has enjoyed, you know, there's a vogue for that now, I would say. But for a long time, it had to be the privileged amateur, you know, the Sherlock Holmes or very eccentric, perhaps foreigners like Poirot. So the big shock of the working class man going into this middle class home in 1860 took about 100 years to wear off.
It's been alluded to somewhat already, William's scientific endeavours, but also Constance's work with the leper colony and so on. And that struck me as being themes of atonement and redemption.
It's what I learnt, but I hope that the way that I presented or told it did reflect the fact that, yes, I found it sort of moving that they survived what had happened and then tried to live honourably in her case, to help others, including she went to sort of young girl offenders home at one point. And so although I know very little about what she thought and said, felt in those years, her actions suggest that she did try to atone. And I think, in fact, her confession is a sort of atonement, and her desire to protect her brother and family, you know, having done something so horrific to one brother, to do something good for another. And I think William's work honoured the fact that he'd been given the chance to do something. He did it very well.
Lady? Yes,
one thing I was really interested in was how you evoked the sort of social structure of the locality and all the different individuals who gave their views in one way or another, testimony or just suggesting the very big class divisions, the people in the big house and the people in the village.
Mm. Well, I did quite a lot of research in the normal places you go for genealogical research, kind of censuses, birth, marriage and death, to try to trace individual villagers and servants and to get as much as possible about them, even if it was knowing if they were married or unmarried, where they were born, how old they were. And I read the local papers quite assiduously from that time to see if names came up, and you'd come across the old policeman on another job a few weeks before and that kind of thing. But mostly, and this is something that it sort of really struck me as I started on this story, it's the fact that when a crime happens, the scene is scrutinised by the press and by the police and by the detectives in a way that is very unusual. And the banal stuff that's going on, you know, what time the housemaid gets up to scald the milk, how many times a week the laundry gets taken away and how much it costs to have it done and when it's brought back and how it's accounted for, these things aren't normally documented in books in the Victorian era. But when there's a crime, they're documented not for the benefit of the likes of me, sort of social people interested in social history, but there's a side benefit that it's an incredibly rich resource for finding out about how people lived in very kind of physical, banal, you know, day to day, hour to hour ways, which aren't that readily available elsewhere.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the thing about Mr. Witcher and the amateur detective. And it seems to me, I hope in the right sense, that he is the exception that proves the rule, really, because although he was formally, speaking, a policeman, surely he was much more like the amateur in that he comes in late and he's opposed to the local police who have comprehensively bungled the first investigation. And then at the end of his investigation, where he is very substantially correct, he is still disgraced and he is not accepted, in effect, by his own police force. So in a real sense, he is the forerunner of people like Sherlock Holmes and Poirot and all the others.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Yes, that's quite true. In a way, the trajectory of what happened to him is the model for the outsider, the amateur and the private investigator. But maybe the two are sort of merged in the modern kind of police detective who is sort of bristling against his superior.
He's always at odds with
everyone.
Superiors.
So it is a kind of amalgam. I'd say the important thing about him being a police detective, in terms of what I'm describing of police detectives falling out of favour as kind of heroes for so long, is his class. I think that he was, before he was in the police force, he was a labourer. All the policemen were, thoroughly working class. And the idea that you were giving these men the right to enter, to speculate, to pronounce, was very subversive and backfired on him, I think. Whereas these amateurs that we're talking about that succeeded him in fiction, they're given a special sort of privilege by virtue of their eccentricity or their foreignness or their poshness, by which, so it's a little different. So in that sense, I'd keep him with the police detective group, but I'd completely take your point that he is the sort of maverick and outsider.
Thank you very much for coming. I think Kate will, you'll sign books here in this very spot, if you'd like your book signed, and I'm sure you'd want me to say thanks to her.
Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.